Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Tim Miller, in for Charlie Sykes for the next 2 days. You're going to have to suffer through me, and I'm so happy to be here today with the pride of Louisville and somebody who's been very encouraging of the work that we're doing at the Bulwark and you know, my midlife crisis transition into, you know, writing and being a content man, Perry Bacon Jr., now at 538, formerly of MSNBC and a bunch of other other journalistic enterprises. Perry, thanks so much for joining me today.
Good to be here, Tim. Yes, we go back a little while. Yeah, so it's good to be here.
Yeah, it's going to be good. So much happening in the news, but I do think it would be good for us to start just by stepping back and looking at what's happening with the Republican Party. You had a really interesting article about a week ago now that Jonathan Lass sort of built on earlier this week about whether or not the Republicans are having an autopsy at all. And you posited essentially that they aren't and that that's abnormal. And, you know, what was your, you know, I'm sure you're calling around on that. What was your main takeaway from that, from writing that article and, you know, from the reporting around it?
So the, you know, for me covering politics a long time, I remember in 2009, I think my first campaign was the 2004 campaign. John Kerry lost, of course. And the Democrats had this whole, like, what do we do? How do we talk to evangelical voters more? You know, what happened on same-sex marriage? They had a whole sort of casting call. What do we do next? It started off with like Mark Warner and John Edwards. Got to find a white guy. It ended up on Barack Obama, who I never would have guessed would be the person, but there was a 4-year, but Obama actually talked about religion and the role it needed to have in politics more. So even he was part of that kind of soul searching. You know, fast forward 2009, one of my, you know, I was at the Post then, and I wrote one of the big articles on how Michael Steele was coming to run the Republican Party. Now he had this big vision for change because the party just lost. 2013, of course, the Republicans literally basically called their document the autopsy. Here's how we're going to change the party because
we lost. Okay, Perry, I just need to fact check you there. Since I was at the RNC and I worked on that, we called it the Growth and Opportunity Project. Y'all called it the autopsy. Yes, fair enough, right. So that was bad branding on our end, probably. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm glad you said that. I just said it in the piece. I remember that now that you said it. And then, after 2016, you had a big fight between sort of a bunch of, you know, 4 or 5 different factions in the Democratic Party all saying, here's why Hillary lost, and so on. So after 2020, so anyway, the point I'm making is usually a party, after it loses a presidential cycle, does 2 things. One, it trashes the person who lost. Romney and Hillary Clinton were trashed by people in their party. And 2, there's a real public discussion about why the party lost and what it needs to change to go forward. And after 2020, that has not happened. Donald Trump is praised publicly by most Republicans in Congress, most Republican leaders, in public at least, and the party has not had a big effort to discuss publicly at least how to change directions or what direction to change. In fact, there's been a few autopsies done since the election. It's been the Democrats who want a trifecta studying why they did poorly with Latino voters compared to 2016. So the Democrats are having a public study. They won. The Republicans are having no study. They lost. That's fairly unusual for modern politics.
Well, I do need to correct you on one point. I don't think that you recall the people that were wearing berets and carrying the John Kerry flag storming the Capitol. You don't remember that in the winter of 2004? No, I do think they tried to turn the page from Kerryism. We talked for this article, and my basic take was that an autopsy isn't happening because the Republican Party looked at the increase in turnout among Trump voters. They feel captured by, you know, having to draw support from Trump voters, and you know, they think that the only path forward basically is by continuing to juice the same voters that Trump turned out and kind of hoping that, you know, either Trump himself or you know, the sort of competent Trump, if you will, the great oxymoron of our time, you know, can come and minimize the Democratic vote in the future. They've got this benefit in the Senate. They've got this, you know, kind of bias in the Electoral College that's benefiting their current coalition. So why change? Was that the consensus view when you were talking to folks, or were there other things at play?
So the consensus view was something like that, or the way I framed it was the Republicans almost won, is that they get, the Democrats talk a lot about how the Republicans are counter-majoritarian, the majority's with us, but it's a fairly slim majority. Like, Biden won 51-47. He didn't win 55-43. So I think, so a lot of people said basically the Republicans kind of almost won this way. And like you said, they, you know, some combination of redistricting, gerrymandering, the Senate and the Electoral College giving Republicans the advantage, the midterm effect, which usually the party in power loses the midterms. All that stuff means the Republicans can probably win the House in 2022, maybe the Senate, and have a great chance in the presidency in 2024 without really changing anything. But the thing that I think is most important is, and I think is most important is, the people who have real power in the Republican Party don't want to change. And what I would say it's not the Mitch McConnell people and Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy, I think, were open to changes. I think if you look at the polling, there's a big block, probably between a third and a half of Republican voters who don't love Trumpism, are open to changes. But I think if you look at the sort of activist core, what I mean by that is like Fox News and the people who watch it, the Club for Growth people and the people who fund that, the sort of people who run state and local parties, who, when Liz Cheney wanted to support impeachment, went after her, the people who are primarying people who say anything bad about Trump. That, to me, that middle layer of the Republican Party, sort of between McConnell and McCarthy and the rank and file voters, I think is where the real power is. And those people really don't want to change, and there's no real counter forces to force them to change. And that's what I think is driving this the most. You might disagree, but that's where I think the biggest tension.
Yeah. No, this is this bottom up versus top down theory of political power that is absolutely right in the modern day. I mean, look, I wrote a longer piece for Rolling Stone during the campaign. I think it was right after the Lafayette Square incident. And I asked all these strategists, why aren't your candidates distancing from him? I mean, it was so unconscionable what he did, so inexcusable. It's going to kill you in the suburbs. Like, his numbers are tanking. So it's kind of his low watermark during the campaign and polling numbers. Why aren't they distancing? And one of these strategists basically said, look, this is different. You know, the types of voters that are leaving Trump are different than the types of voters that were leaving Bush, you know, in 2006 when his numbers were tanking, right? Like that Bush was losing water across the board, right? Everybody, and he was already bottomed out with black voters, but every other class of voter he was going down with, right? You know, every demographic, and you know that included Republican based voters. Trump is still holding, you know, and this was this guy's quote, like Saddam Hussein level approval ratings among Republican base voters in rural and exurban areas, you know, in the South and in, you know, the Midwest. And so the calculus is different, right? Like, these are the voters that have the power within the party. You know, if Trump, I saw a poll yesterday, still has 83, it was this North Carolina Senate poll that had Lara Trump, you know, declaring prima nocta on the Senate, North Carolina Senate seat and winning. She's in first place in this poll, but Trump had 83% approval. You know, if 80% of the party still likes him, you know, what's galvanizing the 20 going to do? And so, you know, you have to respond to the, you know, where the power and where the energy is within the party.
I do think the sort of, and not anti-Trump, but sort of Trump skeptical. When I look at all these polls, I see, like I said, like some 25%, 30%, maybe 40% of people who are Republicans but are sort of ready to move on from Trump. And I do think that 40%, that 30% number is kind of underrepresented, particularly in the House. I think the Senate is probably there, particularly in Republican state parties, particularly on Fox News. Like, I think if you watch MSNBC – during the last 4 years. You certainly had some anchors who were closer to the AOC point of view, but you certainly had Morning Joe and people like that who were like, oh, pull back a little bit. We don't want to go that far to the left. Versus I don't see the sort of countervailing forces. Like if Evan McMullen or The Bulwark had like 4 hours on Fox to give a different version of Republicanism, that would make a difference. I think it would then become like an organizing. Imagine if like Jeb, Mitt Romney, pick a, you know, Will Hurd, got shows on Fox. That would not change the whole party. I think that would give more of a space for an alternative. And I think more people would be like, oh, there is an alternative. Because right now I feel like, even though I know, you know, because I'm a journalist and I was in Washington a long time, I know a lot of kind of Trump skeptical anti-Trump Republicans. I'm not sure those people really have much voices in the culture except in the elite publications read by left-wing people. Like Jennifer Rubin is an important person, but the Washington Post editorial, you know, opinions pages are probably not read by a lot of rank-and-file Republicans in Kentucky.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That was the theory behind Republican voters against Trump, right? And it was why we were trying to take real people and putting ads of their kind of peers in front of them, people that looked and sounded like them. Because now you're absolutely right. And this is my pushback always when people are like, you're still obsessing over Trump at the Bulwark. And I'm like, Trump voters aren't listening to Bulwark, you know? And even that complaint about CNN, which I think was valid in 2015, I don't know that really matters that much right now, right? I mean the voters that that Trump still appeals to are already getting a deluge of Trump content, you know, on Fox and Newsmax and OAN and, you know, all their various, you know, right-wing websites. And it's not like Trump is struggling for oxygen there, and that's where that's where they're getting their information about. Okay, I want to talk about Fox more in a second, but Jonathan Last is, as is his nature, went a little darker than you on the Republican autopsy, and he basically posited a theory that is correct that there is not an autopsy that is maybe reflecting on how Republicans can do better with certain voter classes, but there is an autopsy that is looking into how they can cheat better. And, you know, he cited, the purging of, the few election officials who stood up to the big lie, Vangeveld in Michigan, how Raffensperger might, you know, get primaried, et cetera, Liz Cheney. And you know, the voting law changes going on throughout the country and, you know, basically galvanizing a more popular will and popular support for, you know, taking elections through minority control, whether that be as Bush did in 2000 and Trump in 2016 through the Electoral College, or even more extreme measures, which is what Trump was pushing for through the state legislatures. What was your kind of take on that, which is that they are making some changes, but it's not about how to attract voters, but about how to cheat?
It was kind of what you said in my piece to me. And when I read it, I was like, I wish I had written that story. You know, I mean, because I think that was actually, it was a little more alarmist, but it was probably more accurate as well. Or my story was probably accurate, but it was a little more looking ahead. I think that's exactly right, is that the particularly the focus on the state legislators, like some of these states are getting closer and closer to implying that if the state legislator will basically, our Secretary of State, who's a Republican in some of these states, will not certify the results, or maybe somebody in the counties will not certify the results. Therefore, there's no winner declared. Therefore, the state legislator can choose the winner. And controlled by Republicans, they can choose the Republican winner as the president. I thought that was a very well done piece, and it looks like what we're saying. Like I said, I was trying to say in my pieces, there's not a public forward-looking autopsy saying we lost this way. Like no Republican is going out saying our plan is to win elections through the state legislators. They're not saying
they won.
Right. Because they're saying they won.
They actually won. Yeah.
But they're actually moving toward that model. Although one thing I would say is it's not like a lot of the changes in the electoral laws are happening in places like Iowa and even places like Montana where the Republicans won pretty clearly. So I do think part of these election law changes are to rig the system, but part of them are just to appeal to the base and to appeal to Trump. Like, once you went around the country and said everything's a lie, everything is, you know, the election system is rigged, I think you have to do some of these laws just because you have to, because you've been saying everything is screwed up. So I think some of the policies of the implementing the big lie into law are about election rigging and cheating. But some of them are just, they have to do that now because they've said, if you created this huge problem that there's all this fraudulent voting, you have to pass something.
Yeah. And that's what, I mean, I think that this is the big, you know, element about this Georgia debate, you know, that folks, you know, can miss. Because even Gabriel Sterling, who has come out and said that, you know, the left and the corporate America and the media is overplaying like the merits of what's happening in this bill. You know, even he in those interviews has admitted that the only reason that it is happening in the first place is basically because, you know, these Republicans, Georgia state legislators, feel like they have to do something, right? Like they're pressured to do something. And then you have the whole gamut of people in the legislature, from your true believers who actually think it was rigged, to your racists who actually want to suppress votes, to people who are just, you know, responding to their marketers responding to their customers, right? And so, you know, I just can't be kind of missed in all this. Have you guys looked at all at just like kind of the data, or do you have a sort of broader sense about just this kind of how widespread this kind of belief is that there is legitimate fraud and that these folks
I think the polling I've seen is just the majority of the Republicans. This is a question that's hard to poll, though, because once it becomes like a part of the Republic, being a Republican is hating the media now. But we have a lot of evidence that people that say they hate the media actually do when a big incident happens. Like they do watch ABC, like they watch CNN or ABC News when the George Floyd thing happens. They do trust the media on the sort of big stories. They just don't know, like something less racialized would be a better example. But anyway, they do trust the media on these sort of like, is there COVID? Does COVID exist? They will track the media for that kind of thing. In the same way that, so when you do a poll and ask people, do you trust the election results, you're kind of asking them which party they're in too. And so they're going to give, the polls show a majority of people who say they're Republicans don't trust the election results. I think some of that is true and some of that is kind of like, asking signaling. Which party is signaling. That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to kind of move on and take the, you know, kind of lens back on this sort of voting rights discussion, and I'll sort of let you drive a little bit, because there's just so much going on right now, you know, across multiple vectors with the racial reckoning that's happening in the country. And I think that this is obviously undergirding the debate and the passion around voting rights. You know, we have right now, obviously ongoing, the Derek Chauvin trial, and with the Dante Wright murder yesterday and the arrest, or Dante Wright murder earlier this week and the arrest of the officer yesterday. And you know, kind of this racial, how do you say it? Maybe this sort of social justice awakening, kind of on the left. That's in some ways, you know, uniting, in other ways, kind of dividing. You know, this debate of the left. What do you attribute to, you know, all of these, you know, kind of, you know, increased, you know, racial tensions, you know, increased racial awakenings to, you know, that are all converging at the same time in our politics. And I think it's so interesting that it happened after, you know, the first black president, right? So like you would have, you know, maybe imagined, or I would have maybe, and this is something I missed, that these are things that Obama would have brought to the fore, right? Like the would have been a backlash against him, the fact that he was in there, and obviously there was some of that, and that, you know, based on his perspective, he would have raised the salience over some of these things, and it was, but it just feels so much hotter right now, and I do think it's driving a lot of, you know, the changes in our politics and the motivation in our politics. So just from the biggest possible picture sense, so we can kind of drill down on these things, what's your view on kind of the why?
Okay, so my sense is that 2008, I would say I, a black person, even sort of was like, oh, Obama won. This is like a symbol that the level of racism in America has went down at a pretty large level. I think we sort of knew.
You did feel that way?
I did personally? Feel, yes, me personally. Yes, I did feel that, I would say, in 2008. Like, you know, we had already seen, like, hey, we had, you know, Michael. You should not judge culture based on celebrities. That said, you know, we had Michael Jordan, we had Oprah, we had the rest of the culture. I think culture often drives politics. And so we had the rest of the culture, certain black people were being accepted. And I think there was a sense, my sense was there was a broader acceptance happening. Obama won. And I did think we were moving toward a place where maybe we'd have a black Republican president next. There would be, it would sort of sweep in more tolerance and maybe some racial tension would go down. And there were always going to be questions about the economics, which is like, even though Obama won, the economic data obviously showed even back then that the average black person had much less income and wealth. But I actually did have a lot of optimism about how he won. And I, you know, I'm just speaking for myself. My parents, yeah. I remember, were very much like, is he going to win? Even on the day before the election, I told mom, every poll says he's up by 7 points. You should just plan a party for tonight. Are you sure? My parents were, A, worried that he's going to win, wasn't going to win. You know, they didn't necessarily know the Bradley effect, but they were just sort of generally nervous. Are white people lying about this? Are they really going to vote for a black person? And then my parents throughout the camp, my mom particularly, was worried. A lot of black people were worried that he would be shot during the campaign. That was a continual right. worry. I think Michelle Obama talked about this publicly too. That was a continual worry about him being shot. Would he make it through MLK? Thinking about, you know, black leaders and what's happened to them. So I'll be honest, 2010, Tea Party, 2009, 2010, Tea Party's things really get heated. You know, a lot, then the older black folks were really like, it's racism, we told you. I was sort of like, healthcare bill, really broad, they are moving left. I'm open to both these points of view. I sort of, and then when the birther stuff really heated up, then it became more, it probably took me longer than it probably should have. And then maybe because I was in that DC bubble myself to understand, okay, there is a, I think Colin Powell, there were people who were in that bubble too, were saying, okay, there is, it's not that all people who opposed to Obama are racist. It's just that there are a lot, there is more racism than maybe we should anticipate, maybe we anticipated this driving some of what's happening here. So I think by 2015, it looks, you know, I think Black Lives Matter was able to become so strong in part because of videos, what happened, the idea that Michael Brown was left in the ground, but all on the ground for so long in Ferguson, but and also because of the police shootings that were seen around the town, but also because I think that in the black community, there was a sense that Obama had struggled in part because of racism, and Obama had not been able to overcome the sort of racial problems in the country either. And so the fact that a Black Lives Matter movement emerged while a black person was president, I don't think was an accident. I don't think it was a critique of him, but I think it was a critique of the system and an illustration of the limitations that he faced and could not overcome. And so I think there was an initial Black Lives Matter movement that was really mostly about black people, particularly younger black people saying the system is really strong. What I think happened with Trump is that he sort of accelerated that feeling that there was racism in the country and sort of brought white liberals along. So I think by the time Trump ran, the way he won, and we started seeing that in the data in like 2017 was when I started seeing, when you asked, I think Pew asked this question of, do black people have equal rights to and equal opportunities to white people? In the Obama era, like most black people had said no, but even some black people said yes, there is equal rights. But most white Democrats, about half of white Democrats thought black people basically had equal opportunities and rights as white people. By 2017, that had changed. The black number who felt there was discrimination had went up slightly, but it was already very high. But the white Democrat number went from like 50 to 78 in that period from 2015 to 2018. And that, so I think that Trump really drove a lot of white people to sort of, you know, they sort of woke them up, so to speak, about racial issues in the country combined with Black Lives Matter. So you carry that forward. Trump is behaving in a racist way, often making that more explicit. People who feel like they hate Trump feel like being on the right side of issues means they have to be sort of more lefty on racial issues particularly. And I think that led to the, and then I think the COVID thing really adds up to where you know, people have been talking for a long time about systemic racism, but then the data really shows that a virus comes to the country and it hits Black people in clear numbers, more Black people are affected. So I think the Trump effect combined with COVID, combined with George Floyd, combined with Black Lives Matter already existing, all four of these things sort of came together. And I think that's where we are now, where you have, at this point in the world's history, I think being a Democrat in America sort of almost first means I'm a person who cares about racial justice and racial equality. I think the Democratic Party in many ways is now sort of more anti-racism than it is populism.
Yeah, I look, there's so much that I want to talk about. But I completely agree with that, and to the point where I actually think the you know, sort of negative of that statement is true, which is that a lot of people are basically saying, you know, that they say that I cannot be, you know, a Republican because right. I think that racism is a problem in this country, you know, and I think that just looking at my peer group,
which is like sort of younger Republicans, right?
Yeah, which is like, yeah, younger, you know, 30 something, you know, elder millennial Republicans, if you will. You know, the switch from them to urban dwelling from being kind of, you know, either soft Republicans or swing voters. I'm not talking about like my political friends, my high school and college friends. To almost unanimously voting for Joe Biden. Was driven almost entirely by this. I mean, it was also just because Trump's an insane person, right? But you know, you see in their kind of social media posts and their commentary a much more visible awareness of the problem of racism, much more wanting to make sure that it is, you know, both, you know, kind of in the signaling way, but I think also in a genuine personal way that they are kind of reckoning with this and siding, you know, in this sort of fissure in this country with the side that says, no, racism is a problem. We have to deal with this. And I cannot be on the side, you know, that is either, you know, in the best case, diminishing it as a problem, or, you know, in many cases, actually kind of inflaming the problem. And so I think that has driven a big part of the shift of the kind of suburban white Republican, you know, sort of culturally, you know, whatever, globalist, culturally urban kind of Republican vote to switch the Democratic Party. And I think that like the kind of the red dogs that I wrote about, a lot of them, I think are driven by this. But, and I think that a lot of them had, you know, and for me, just speaking for myself, you know, the same experience as you, though, you know,
you're not Black. I get it.
Yeah. No. I guess I'm just saying it's not the same experience in that I guess I was not aware of the racist problems before Obama to the same degree as you. Yeah. But the same experience of Obama being elected and thinking, oh, man, things are great. You know, like I don't have to worry about this at all. And so I was totally blind. I feel like I was totally blind. So this is not the same experience. I was totally blinded by this, like right after 2008. And I think that a lot of my peers felt that way too, right? And that this has been, you know, kind of a big wake up call, so to speak, you know, over the last 10 years. So I guess my question to you is like, was this an inevitable, you know, sort of change in mindset over that time period among white voters, do you think? Or do you think that like just the kind of grotesque, you know, behavior of Donald Trump and just how, you know, ham-handedly bigoted he is, you know, sort of created some of this that maybe would have been, you know, continued to be, you know, happening mostly in kind of left wing or, you know, sort of more, you know, diverse communities.
That's an interesting question. So part of it is like the Republican Party has always, you know, the Southern, we can talk about, there's always been elements of this kind of anti-Black sentiment in Republican sure. circles and maybe in Republican leadership circles at times. So where that, so to me, there was like a seminal moment. I remember, you know, I think I saw you a lot around this time in 2015, where it became clear to me, oh, Jeb and Marco Rubio, if they win, we might, you know, we're seeing, to me, maybe the last remnants of a really kind of anti-Black, you know, racist approach to Republican politics. And now we're in a primary to where this is the issue now. And Jeb and Rubio are really on one side, in my view of it. And Trump particularly is on the other side of it. And I found myself being, you know, I'm a reporter, I'm trying to be objective, but I found myself being like, oh boy, Jeb winning would be a relief over Trump. You know, I mean, you know, or like in the sense of being a black person in America, knowing what it might be like if this person is president, I was a little nervous about that. And then kind of what I thought, would I do think there was a line of demarcation where I'm not saying Jeb's not a liberal. I'm sure Jeb would do things I disagree with, things other black people would disagree with. But Jeb on those racial, sort of Jeb, you could tell, imagined a multiracial country and a multiracial democracy and seemed very comfortable with that. Marco Rubio, I think, was more comfortable particularly then as well. And so I think that I think Trump clarified racial issues for a lot of people. It's like, I live in Kentucky now. Louisville's a pretty segregated city in a lot of ways. And I know a lot of white people I grew up with sort of didn't really understand, you know, we talked about racial issues, we talked about there's a racial divide, but that was all sort of theoretical to them. They had some black friends. They didn't necessarily go to the black areas, but they didn't really understand it. And I think Trump, the way he talked about racial issues, go back to your country, he talked about immigration, yeah, just the way he framed it, I think, clarified, there's two sides of this, and I want to be on the right side of this, I think without Trump, you don't have this kind of reckoning. No, I think Trump, and I'm not saying that necessarily that I'm not saying there wouldn't be racial discussions, because we had Black Lives Matter when Obama was president too. If Jeb is president, do we have police shootings? Of course. Do we have discussions of that? Of course. But I think that the core divide and how it became the center of our politics. Now I feel like every issue in politics is sort of, every issue was always racialized, but I would say politics is about race right now. And I don't think that would have happened except for a Donald Trump being the president.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that, because I just think, like, talking about my own blind spots, like looking back to Ferguson, and you know, like it just that like the outrage over that, you know, while there was definitely some, particularly in left wing circles in white America, like really felt like this, you know, kind of outrage that was emanating from Black America, that like my peer group was kind of separate from, you know, in a way that changed between then and George Floyd. And you know, when I look back and when you're, it's interesting hearing about your kind of conversations growing up in Louisville. I think about that growing up in Denver is, you know, like I'm born in 81, right? So the, you know, to me, like Martin Luther King and the civil rights fights and, you know, John Lewis and all this stuff felt like history. You know, growing up, like it felt like it was in the past, and this was something that you studied in the history books the same way like you studied the revolution, right? Like it really did to me growing up. And I think about that now. I think about like that's like the equivalent of my daughter of like 9/11, right? She's born in 2018, right? So like 9/11 is to her as Martin Luther King and the civil rights fights were to me, and obviously, kind of, you know, all of the issues related to 9/11 and in the Iraq War and all that feel very much not like history to me, but like present, right? And I think that what had happened with Trump really did kind of open up, you know, a lot of, you know, folks in my camp's eyes to the fact that this is not a history problem, but it's a present problem.
And one thing I want to emphasize is this is, politics is racialized. It's not necessarily racial. Like, you know, like a lot of people were surprised that Trump, you know, didn't, I guess he went from 9 to 11 or whatever, a small number of black voters. He increased the number of black voters. He had a meaningful gain with Latino voters. And also white men were the group that most switched to Biden from Trump. I think that, you know, right. I know that jumped out at people. That did not necessarily surprise me. And let me sort of, is that like racial attitudes and people's races are not entirely connected. And what I might say is there are plenty of, there is not a huge number, but there are some black people who have sort of negative views about black people, who sort of have racial views closer to Donald Trump than Joe Biden or to Barack Obama for that matter. There are Latinos who have racial views that are more conservative, which means, you know, when you talk about the police in particular, once 2020 became a debate about who, you know, is BLM right or the police right, that definitely was going to split people by racial attitudes, but not necessarily by race. There are plenty of people in law enforcement who are Black and Latino who thinks those that law enforcement is good and mostly and is unfairly demonized. So I think what we're also going through is that people are learning about race more in America, and I think that's good. But I think we've got to get to a more sophisticated conversation, which is that it is not always there are Black conservatives. Period. There always were. Sure. All Black people are not liberal. They most of them do vote for Democrats, but that's more because of the history of the Republican Party on race. And I think if a Larry Hogan, Condi Rice, Tim Scott style person ran for president and sort of ran on a pretty moderate a moderate platform on racial issues, I think they would get more than the 10% of Black votes. I think these groups are all sort of movable because we're all like, we all have a race, but it's not necessarily a sign, but our politics are more about our racial attitudes than our race. And those things are the same, but like the people who are reading, you know, Caste and How to Be an Anti-Racist are the leading books on the bookseller list. That's not Black people buying those books. That's mostly white liberals buying those books to sort of get right on racial. I don't condemn them for buying it, but that's who's buying those books.
Yeah. I just want to kind of clarify one thing on points you're making, just on the different on the white men moving to Biden. Just since this is what we were kind of analyzing and with Arvat. This isn't surprising to me all just when you kind of think about this anecdotally, because there's also sexism at play too, right? And right. Like the idea that, you know, if you're a white suburban, you know, kind of, you know, red dog or soft Republican or, you know, kind of Republican who, you know, might be gettable swing voter, you know, your wife voted probably for Hillary last time, you know, you had, you know, been demonized, you know, the Fox News and Republican campaigns and me had been demonizing the Clintons and Hillary for years. And so you kind of bought into all of that. And, you know, there's this kind of latent sexism and, you know, boy, that's a big jump to make you go from Mitt Romney to Hillary Clinton. And then, you know, then after 4 years of Donald Trump's just horrific behavior and, you know, having to hear about it from your wife and your kids and your friends. And it's like, then Joe Biden, you know, Uncle Joe comes along and like, that's a much softer landing spot, right? For these, for kind of white college educated men, which were the big kind of moving groups. I didn't end up being surprised by that. I just, before we move off, I want to talk about the Democratic Party, but this is maybe a little transition into it. Your point about having this more sophisticated conversation on race, I do think that among, for lack of a better term, the kind of the bulwark crowd, you know, I think that it's much more, you know, kind of open to kind of hearing these social justice arguments and changing their views. And, you know, I hear from a lot of people, you know, who are both, you know, kind of write and read for us who have kind of evolving and awakening views on the matter. But there also is a pushback to, you know, kind of what is, you know, some of the excesses of the social justice left and, you know, wokeism or whatever it is. You know, you see some of this, you know, manifesting itself on campus, but also on campaigns. You know, there's this kind of discussion, you know, that David Shore and others have been pushing about how, you know, that Democratic campaigns are, you know, maybe a little bit too, you know, campus race, you know, critical race theory or, you know, organized and, you know, talking to Latinx voters when it's only, you know, white liberals at Amherst that say Latinx and not actually Latino voters who say that. Like, what's your take on what's happening in the left and whether that's a realistic concern or whether we're missing something when we kind of criticize that overreach.
So there's a lot to unpack here. So I guess let me give two thoughts here. The first is,
can you in 1 minute give me all of your thoughts on critical race theory, Perry?
You know, which I can't explain. I've got a hard time explaining it. So I think elections are really hard. So I'm not convinced that necessarily like the slogan deep, obviously my point might be Democratic candidates probably should not call for defund the police, but I don't think a ton of them were. So it's not clear to me exactly how the Democratic Party can tell act like the Democratic elected officials who said defund the police, Nancy Pelosi should have a meeting with them and say, I would prefer you not say this. And I think I gather she's doing that. But in terms of like activist groups, like Fox News can take whatever they want to from anybody anywhere in America who is part of some group that's the socialist of Orange County or wherever and say Democrats think X. So I think in terms of like it's going to be hard to, like the genie's out of the bottle. You now have a lot of social justice activists who are at the local level, the Twitter level, et cetera, who are going to say whatever they want to say and who are pushing forward. And this is a new part. And, you know, and we now have Twitter. So everybody's opinions about anything can be on Fox News or even for that matter, ABC News or 538 in, you know, 1 minute after they say them. So I think that is going to be hard to put in the genie about. It's going to be harder for the Democratic Party to control. It's more like 80 million people voted for Biden. It's going to be hard for those 80 million people to be restrained from making controversial comments in public. I do think that overall, there's two things that happen that are important. One is that I don't love the phrase Overton window shifting generally, but I think this idea that the police are a problem and we need to have real aggressive reforms of them and maybe that they should have some funding reallocated to social services. I think if you phrase that idea the way I phrased it, that idea actually is not particularly unpopular and in some cases popular. And so I do think the discussion about sort of racial, like reparations is not currently popular. But if you phrase it in terms of we're going to give housing vouchers to people who discriminate against their housing, that's more popular. So I think the left-wing activism on policy issues often is responding to real inequality and if framed well can have useful ideas. Now, the discourse on Twitter about Latinx, I do think this sort of I'm skeptical of like how many people are actually losing their jobs because of cancel culture. But did I look at the Teen Vogue thing and think that was a great example of American discourse? No, I did not. I mean, my general take on cancel culture, whatever we're talking about, is that I think we're really debating is what are you allowed to say in our culture? And more importantly, what are the consequences of it? And I would say, one, we've always had evolving debates about what is acceptable. Like in 2007, Barack Obama was against gay marriage. In 2020, basically nobody wants to be acceptable society says they're against gay marriage. So standards always evolve and we always think about that. But to me, the question is, what should the punishments be for violating those? And I'm just a person who believes in forgiveness and apologies and you should be accountable, but there not shouldn't be a lot of death sentences. I'm very aware of the idea anyone should be fired from any job for what they say on Twitter or their political opinions. If you're going around calling people the N-word all the time, that's one thing, but nobody's really doing that I see. And so to me, the standard for, I think it's more in an employment context to be, I just wish employers were less eager to demote or fire people because there was a PR controversy over somebody's tweet. It's just like your job should not be contested or you should not be removed from it because of what you tweet if it's sort of in the range of normal opinions. That's kind of how I feel about it. It's like we should just stop firing people and for things they say on Twitter.
It does feel like sometimes that the anti-PC right, really it all just does come down to the fact that they still wish they could make racist jokes, you know, and not get in trouble for it. Sometimes this debate feels like it limits to that. I do want to talk about the Democrats, but I think you mentioned the Overton window on the left. We would be remiss if we just didn't really quick, kind of add on this point that the Overton window on the right, you know, like we're going opposite directions,
yes,
right, on the race thing. I mean, the fact that Tucker Carlson this week is literally calling for white replacement theory, you know, and saying that that's not such a, you know, bad idea. Donald Trump, I remember, people don't recall this from 2016, for whatever reason, because he has so many outrages. But when he was attacking Jeb over his wife, being from Mexico and then that affecting Jeb's view on immigration, he retweeted this account that the account was literally at white genocide and then some number like. You know, like this is the theory that like white people are being eliminated by, you know, immigrants who are coming into the country, brown and black immigrants who are like sleeping with, you know, white women and, you know, kind of ending the right white race. The president tweeted somebody whose handle was promoting this theory. Right. And so I do think that Trump did open up the over. You know, it's hard to imagine, you know, a Fox primetime host, you know, in alternate Earth B where Marco is president, like talking about the problems of what, you know, of the need for you know, to take seriously white replacement theory and the, and their concerns about white genocide, right? Like you have with Tucker. And I think that it is really notable that, that after the election, after the insurrection, where Fox could have pivoted back towards, you know, hey guys, like we need to put the bumpers back on this. And you've seen the opposite, like the wheels totally off, to mix my metaphor there.
It's terrifying. That's all I would say. Nothing really to say. Yeah.
Yeah. Horrible. Horrifying. Okay. To the Democrats before we leave, you wrote a, It's been a while now, but it was super, I think, prescient back during the Democratic primaries, an article about how my people, the Never Trumpers, might end up actually having more of an impact on what is the discourse in the Democratic Party than they have in the Republican. Like, we're so weak and so minimized within our own party.
I didn't quite say it so bluntly, but that's what I think. Yes, correct.
Yeah. We're very weak that we were so cucked by the Donald Trump, MAGA Chad wing of the party, that we had no influence left. But I think that you were really the first kind of to observe something that I was kind of secretly noting but not saying out loud, which was that there it was having some impact on what's happening in the Democratic Party and kind of shaping that coalition a bit, you know. And meanwhile, you know, you have kind of the other, you know, this other group within the Democratic Party, which is, you know, on policy matters, that's really kind of pushing kind of stealthily, in some ways, Joe Biden to the left, unstealthily in other ways. Take on either one of those sides of what's happening in the party first, and we'll cover both.
So I thought the Never Trump group, and I guess I don't know how intentional it was, but I just thought it was fascinating. I don't know if it was intentional or what, but MSNBC and the Washington Post and CNN around 2016, 2017 went away from hiring. You know, for a while, what was the guy? They were sort of hiring
Jeffrey Lord
is what I'm thinking about. Yes, Jeffrey Lord. They were hiring these sort of crazy, I'm for Trump no matter what defenders, and who were bad guests on TV and just terrible. But then they went to hire a lot of people like Jennifer Rubin, like Bill Kristol, who were on TV, featured a lot prominently, the sort of Never Trump crowd. And once those people got a foothold, I began to think, Democrats are obsessed with, Nicole Wallace being a good example, Democrats are obsessed with finding an electable candidate. So obviously they're going to look for who the Republicans like and will vote for, the ex-Republicans will like and vote for. And I could also tell that by 2018, it was obvious to me that the Never Trump people were not having much influence in terms of Republican primaries and so on. So 2019, I thought there was going to be a Larry Hogan or somebody challenging Trump. Then it became clear
we worked on that.
I know. Yeah, exactly. And so once it became clear that wasn't going to happen, I was talking to more, I talked to Evan McMullen, so I talked to people like you. Once it became clear that wasn't going to happen, I did think by like December 2019, these guys are all in really good positions. They have Washington Post columns and New York Times columns and MSNBC columns. They're in a great position to really impact the Democratic primary. The Democratic voters want to know who can win. If Steve Smith and Nicole Wallace say Joe Biden will get my vote, that'll help. And so then, like once Sanders won those early primaries, then it really went into action in a way that even I did not think of, where I saw Tim Miller. I saw things Tim Miller wrote in his pieces appear in other pieces written by pro-Biden liberals, sometimes attributed to Tim Miller, sometimes not. But it was sort of obvious that the Never Trump people had taken advantage smartly of their position within the Democratic Party and said, guys, we just watched Donald Trump take over our party. Don't let this happen with Sanders. And that was a very strategic, I think it was probably intentional at times, but I'm not sure Jennifer Rubin sat down and was like, let me change the Democratic Party. I think there's a lot of things happened where the Never Trump folks had no influence in one party. But part of it is the Democratic Party is more diverse in all kinds of ways. It's more racially diverse. It's more religiously diverse. And also it's more inclusive of other people. So it's not surprising to me a new faction could emerge in the Democratic Party and shape it, because the Democratic Party, like BLM, no one had heard of Black Lives Matter in 2015. And now it kind of runs the Democratic Party. Right. And so the Democrats are more porous in a certain way. So I wasn't surprised by that. I have also been surprised, honestly, by how Biden has governed in terms of moving left. And I think COVID is a big part of that. But I also think that, like, the AOC crowd, I think, is underappreciated in how in their strategery and how smart they are. And strategy, obviously, as I meant to say, and how they can move stuff. And I think that at this point, it's like AOC's agenda is not passing. Bernie's idea is not being passing. These people are not dumb. Senator Warren knows if she keeps saying $50,000 in student debt should be forgiven, Biden might go from 10 to 25. That's the goal. These people are trying, all they're doing, like the people on the Democratic left are in a pretty obvious and clear Overton window exercise constantly. Like when Biden's released his infrastructure plan and AOC was like, it's not big enough. What else was she going to say? Of course she said that. If she had said, I would have been shocked if she said it was good. You know, I mean, like, so I think these people are in a strategic exercise that is pretty smart. And I think Biden has been more amenable than their ideas than they expected, in part because this is a smart dance. They come out with extremely left ideas. Old man Joe comes out with his slightly left ideas. And the media is like, look how moderate he is. This is a great dance. They should. I mean, I think it's really working so far.
Yeah, I do too. And I think that you hit on an important distinction and one that I tried to tell reporters a lot during the campaign, but that they were always very skeptical of, which is that I without sounding too self-aggrandizing, I do think that the Never Trumpers have influenced the Democrats on politics.
Yes.
More than policy. Right. And I think that taking a more aggressive posture towards Trump, thinking about reining in some of the making people more conscious about reining in rhetorical excesses, you know, in ways that like, you know, we know how Republicans think. We know how they're going to use this against you. Like, is this really worth it? That sort of strategic thinking, the types of things that people talk about on MSNBC panels. Right. Like, I think
that the idea that there are swing voters, there was a view on the left that swing voters yes. weren't really real for like a while. And I think there are fewer swing voters than there were in 92, but there are definitely swing voters and they do matter.
Yeah, swing voters are the reason that Joe Biden's the president.
That's what I was going to say.
It was in a couple key districts, right? So absolutely. So yes, I think that we kind of reformed that conversation a little bit. You know, I would often hear, like, you know, I'd go on MSNBC and like hear from some congressional Democrat office who's like, I've been telling the DCCC this, you know what I mean? Like, we should do this, right? So I think that from a strategery, George W. Throwback standpoint, That definitely has had an impact. I don't think it's had a policy impact, and I think the big reason is that is because most of the Never Trumpers don't have policy litmus tests that they're demanding. You know, like they genuinely, and I think that a lot of liberals just don't believe that this is true, just genuinely wanted Donald Trump out and like felt like he was such this threat to democracy and think that the continued Trumpism in the party is such a threat to the fabric of the country that it's like, you know, we already knew we were making sacrifices on abortion when we changed sides, right? Like, you know, it's not as if we're trying to pull people back, right? And so, you know, from a strategy standpoint, you know, I think that there are times where it's like, hey, this policy that you're proposing is not going to go over well with voters that are gettable for you. I think that we're getting a hearing on some of that kind of stuff. But it wasn't this sort of policy debate. Whereas, meanwhile, the left-wing activists are pretty much all policy oriented. There are a handful of lefty activists on Twitter who are all tactics, no policy. But it's mostly a policy influence that they're pushing. And I think that's what you're seeing, you know, Biden basically appeal to them, not give them everything they want. But I think that's the key distinction between what's happening.
So I remember, I didn't know this. Like, I remember I talked to you for my piece on Never Trump Republicans, and like, it ran in like during the primary, March 2020, it ran, April 2020, one of those. And I asked you, now that you're part of the Biden coalition, Tim, what do you want? And you were like, nothing. I was like, what is your list? I was thinking about this from most groups in the Democratic coalition have a list of seven demands. The black people want this. The Planned Parenthood people want this. You know, and so you know this. I was like, the Never Trump people must have their list of demands. And you were like, I just want Trump out. I don't have any demands. You know, I think Biden should move right on abortion, not for me, but because it'll actually help with swing voters. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. You know, I think that's probably right. And so that surprised me. I do think yesterday is going to test this a little bit, but not too much. Like, I do think my guess is, I haven't done a poll of this yet. My guess is the Never Trump crowd generally does not like this pullout from Afghanistan and would have preferred Biden not take this policy. But I don't think that's such a big break that's going to hurt him long term with the Never Trump crowd, is my impression. But I do think that's, the sort of deal with Biden is don't go too far sort of left on foreign policy is part of the deal. Is that right? Or is that wrong too?
I just don't think so. Afghanistan for 20 years, you know?
Yeah, there's a debate about the policy. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Like, look, yeah, on balance, you know, if you polled the Never Trumpers who voted for Biden, you know, would they be for staying in Afghanistan? Probably. I don't know. This is just not a litmus test issue anymore for people. You know what I mean? It just isn't. Biden on foreign policy, we're getting what we want, which is, you know, this sort of fundamental belief that America is a force for good in the world, right? I think that it would have been different if you had Byrne, right? Like, it would be different if you had a leftist Democratic president who, you know, was an isolationist in their own right, right? You know, but I think that, you know, we may not get everything we're looking for in foreign policy. Biden is much more in this kind of bipartisan, you know, tradition of, you know, believing America, American values are net plus in the world and that we should engage, and that we should care about, our values like that. Like, that's a big upgrade for us over Trump. So no, I think that some of the stuff, right? Like the abortion thing is, like, my point to you back then was, I wish that he would just throw a bone on, you know, going back to save legal and rare, right? Like, even if it's like rhetorical, right? Like, it's avoiding some of the extreme excesses, right? And I think that it's not just that issue. I think that there are going to be other issues where maybe, you know, obviously defund the police is sort of the most obvious one. But on a lot of this stuff, I just think that the voters really reprioritize I think that there's this tiny sliver of Never Trump voters who just hated him so much and are still rock ribbed conservatives and are never going to really vote for Democrats anyway, right? Like, but I'm not talking about those people. The people that voted for Democrats in the midterms in 2018, the people that voted for Joe Biden, do they wish that there were, you know, that he kept the Keystone Pipeline? Yeah, right. Like, do they wish that there were, you know, he was trimming regulations that the, you know, that the corporate rate only goes to 25 instead of 28? Sure. But are any of these litmus tests? No. They've reprioritized what they care about. And they care about protecting American democracy and what we were talking about earlier about us being a multiracial, pluralistic society where everybody is respected. And that's the priority now. And that, I think, gives Biden a lot of room to run in a way that kind of benefits him politically for keeping the coalition together.
And I think having, like, I've been reading David Brooks a lot this, because I was curious, like, I've been sort of waiting, when are the Never Trump people going to break up with Biden over what? And I think I didn't sufficiently appreciate some of those people have moved now. They're not grading Biden on the same, as long as Biden portrays, you know, Biden is trying to unify the country and be center left and not extreme left. And as long as he stays in that general vein, they're going to be comfortable with him, which I don't think I fully appreciate.
Yeah, I had a different reporter, Politico reporter, called me and said, who do Never Trumpers want in the cabinet and at the staffing level? I just laughed. I was like, you think we give a shit if Meg Whitman is the Commerce Department secretary? Like, we just want to get rid of this asshole. But, you know, she's like, that's not all the Democratic groups I call have a specific list of people that they want in the cabinet. And I'm like, we are honestly, like, we couldn't care less if Cindy
McCain. It's interesting to have a Democratic group that doesn't have a list of demands, because almost all of them have very precise list of demands.
Okay, final thing. Do you have any gossip for us about, you know, I mean, you're in the kind of Nate Silver, you know, sort of genius bubble of doom. You know, do you have any sort of gossip or interesting little funny stories about, you know, behind the scenes of the Nate Silver universe?
I mean, you mentioned that there's not a sort of, what is it, Trump, but more smarter, is that what you said?
That doesn't exist. Competent Trumpism. Yeah.
You know, we are, as a site, probably the leading boosters of the Ron DeSantis campaign. You know, whether you think he's, like, good for the country, and I think there are a lot of things he's doing that are not ideal. We did this, like, draft of, I wasn't involved in this personally, but we did this draft of, like, who would you bet on now for 2024, because we cover 2024 pretty aggressively already.
Yeah.
And so Ron DeSantis was, I think, first, other than Trump, was first. We have written about him a lot. We're very interested in Ron DeSantis. So we have a divide on the staff where a few people think there's a potential for a Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, kind of more traditional Republican. And the other people who think, please, we did this with Rubio and Jeb already. Shut
please.
It. You know, it's going to be between Kristi Noem, Ron DeSantis, and Greg Abbott if he gets a little more crazy. But he needs to ramp up the crazy a little more first. And so we are sort of debating that a lot. We are obsessed with 2024. And we've also had, I mentioned on a podcast, you know, I follow what Kamala does very carefully. People were like, we got to talk about that. Is she running? What do you think? You know, I was like, and yeah, honestly, I think Kamala, Terry McAuliffe, and until recently, Andrew Cuomo, were all sort of informally running for 2024. And I think about 2024 more than, and that should be all the 2024 discussion you have on your podcast for a while.
Yeah, a lot. Oh my God. I was like, can we just enjoy this for a second? I do think that the liberal, we were talking earlier briefly about how, you know, giving oxygen to Trump and how this is a stupid argument because Trump already has maximum oxygen among his voters. The Ron DeSantis thing, I do sometimes wonder, and maybe Nate Silver is the person. I've been thinking that there's a Ron DeSantis resistance inside the liberal media and that they're doing everything they can to help Ron DeSantis by continuing to attack him.
We cover him a lot, yes. Oh, so I wanted to bring up one thing on your end. You might have asked you a question?
Okay. No, please. Turn the tables. Put me in the chair.
So the piece you wrote something right after the election. Like, I write a lot about, you know, race. I'm black. I write about race. It's, you know, but I think identity is like a core part of like who we are. And like people have a lot of different identities. Like, you know, I'm from Louisville. I live in Louisville. I'm black. I'm a journalist. So what's it been like for you? Because you've made these two big changes. You went from being a Republican to being an independent. You also went from being a sort of a operative strategist, pick your word, to sort of being in writing. What have those two been like for you, and which one's been harder?
Oh man, that's a great question. I also went from being a closeted gay to an openly gay American. And
when
that happened in 07, right? So okay. It was right after I was on McCain. So I'd been in Republican politics a little bit. And so I think that made it easier for me to make this change, obviously, because that was such a hard thing. Coming out of the closet was so hard. And doing it, I felt so great afterwards. Honestly, like I felt this sort of weight lifted off my shoulders, and I felt like it kind of honestly changed my whole demeanor. It made me more, I think, honest, because I wasn't carrying this lie around all the time with me, and just more comfortable in my own skin. And so I kept trying to look back on that experience as I was thinking about all of this, and you know, in some ways I wanted to do it quicker. But I felt like the right thing to do was to, I weighed this, right? Like whether or not, I should, after 2016, I should just say, screw it and go try to do something completely new in my life, or whether I needed to kind of ride this fight out that I'd been in, right? I just asked everybody in my life what they thought, and I had one drink with a guy who really, it kind of just stuck with me. He's like, I mean, you've just put so much into fighting Trump, and like to walk off the field right now and go do something else just seems like such a mistake. And so and that kind of stuck with me, and I was like, okay, well, I need to keep my operative hat on, keep my Republican hat on, because like you mentioned with Larry Hogan, like I thought that the first line of this fight is going to be within the Republican Party. I knew it was an unlikely fight, but I thought it was one that was worth doing. And even throughout that whole time, I just knew it wasn't a fit, right? Like I just knew I wasn't in my own skin anymore. And so this change has been really great so far. I guess when it was that right after the election, November, so it's only been about 5 months. And, you know, it is still kind of weird to be a journalist, calling people and doing interviews, especially with my old friends in politics. And they're like, I have to be off the record. Like, that's just such an awkward, you know, right. It was just like kind of like these, the original things after coming out of the closet, but like, oh, I'm my boyfriend, you know, like there's these new words and language you have to use when you sort of change identities. So that's been a little bit awkward, but it's felt really good. And I think that like my main because I went through that, I think, with coming out of the closet, and because I went through this with sort of losing the Republican Party, which was such a big part of my identity. I worked on campaigns age 16, Perry. Like, my first campaign job, I was 16. And so, like, this has been my whole life. And, you know, I just that was, I think, my big in the, not my big because of Sarah and all the other people who are involved. But our big insight in RVAT was that these videos helped people make that transition. Right. And helped people like deal with the fact that like this is not just a change of a vote. Like this is a change of something that happened in my identity. And it, in the end, most people said it just felt like such a relief, and they felt like they were really kind of able to be fully themselves, fully honest. And so I know that feels sometimes weird for non-political people. This, I think, that article feels kind of weird, right? Because it's like they don't think that much about who they vote for. But for people for whom political party has been such a part of their, you know, identity, it is a big shift. It's an ongoing shift. And I don't know, man.
It felt really great. And you gain some friends, or I assume you've lost some relationships and changed over this period, right?
I absolutely have lost relationships, and you know, I got married during all of this, and you know, I had no shows to the wedding, like over Trump, basically, right? So
people you've known a long time, people have been to your weddings, people you've known
politics. I mean, not my high school and college. You know what I mean? Like, sure. I thank God there's a lot, and you're in Louisville, so I'm sure you're like this too. But there's a lot of people in politics who like don't have. I always thought it was weird when I'd go to political colleagues' weddings, and everybody there seemed like they were in politics. Yes. I was like, don't you have any real life? Don't you have a real life? So like I'm lucky to have like a whole, you know, really great group of kind of friends and family that are basically apolitical to varying degrees. And so, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal, right? In that sense. But yeah, people that I'd known in politics, my close friends in Republican campaigns, like people that, you know, were in my Republican, you know, friend group, just didn't make the trip. And so, you know, it's so funny. I was like, to think about going back to 2007, me coming out of the closet and to be like, I'm going to have a gay wedding and people aren't going to show, you know, I would have assumed it would have been like anti-gay, you know, whatever, older family or something. And it's like, no, all of them showed. And it was people that were mad at me for saying no to Donald Trump who didn't show. So it's such a weird experience. But yeah, that is, it's, you know, I think that it's something that a lot of folks went through this. And my big message to anybody who like my lesson through all of this is like, don't get stuck because of inertia or because you feel like you have to be attached to this identity that you attached yourself or that other people attached to you. Like literally the best decisions I ever made in my life were changing my identities when I needed to do it, to be honest with myself, like coming out of the closet, opposing Trump. Like, these are the best decisions I ever made. And so, you know, hopefully that can give people some, you know, a little bit of kick in the ass if they need one.
One more about the racial stuff, though. So my wife is white and we're raising a biracial child. And that's definitely making me think about racial issues sort of differently in that, like, I'm trying to figure, you know, I found myself asking my wife, like, what you guys are German and what else? And so how do we sort of develop that part? You know, and she asked me questions like that too. Cause like, you know, I sort of like, I am black, but that's sort of just how I was raised. It's who I don't really think about it. But when the world we're in now, I'm much more conscious. You know, we went to church. We went to a black church. We just went to a church. And that was the church we went to. Right. My dad was the pastor. We didn't really think about it in the racial context of it. And now like, I would not say I'm probably more woke myself than I was maybe 6 or 7 years ago about, like, you know, like a lot of the places I worked at when I was coming up were pretty white. I was the only black person there. And I didn't think about how that happened, why that happened, what does that mean, how that changed my outlook. And now I'm thinking about it more. So talk about your parenting experience. I'm just curious about that as raising.
I would like to turn it on you. We could do a whole episode on parenting because I'm still navigating in the dark. So, we adopted a black daughter a few years ago, which obviously has also impacted my POV on this. And I loathed Trump before we had made the adoption. So, you know, obviously I was already headed down this path, but, you know, watching him doing the send them back stuff, and, you know, obviously had an increased salience for me. I don't know the parenting thing. I think it's gonna be tough and interesting. I think the nice thing is that that, you know, I don't want to be blinded in the same way that we were by the Obama victory to think that, like, you know, time heals all and everything gets inexorably better. But I do think that, you know, I don't even know this. She's not even going to be a Zoomer. Whatever the next generation after the Zoomers are is you know, going to live in a country that is, you know, much more, you know, diverse and integrated than the one that I grew up in, obviously in suburban Denver. And so I'm just trying to be really conscious of it. You know, we live in Oakland, like our community and the little school that she's going to go to in September is like a United Nations, you know, like we're, in some ways, like I carry this kind of, I don't know if guilt's the right word, but something that I think about is like we're gentrifiers basically in Oakland. So I kind of think about that, which carries some weighty negative things that I try to think about and navigate, but also is nice for, it's good for her, right? Because like this is just a very diverse community. Like we're kind of like, I guess, white majority minority neighborhood that we're in. And, you know, I think about that if we decide to move, like we're very conscious of that, what kind of schools she's gonna be in. I think about, you know, stuff that I didn't do. Like we got to get her into a dance troupe with other black kids. Otherwise she's going to start dancing like me and my husband, which is not, you know, which is not going to look very cool among her peer group. So, you know, I'm just kind of working through all of that now. And it obviously has impacted my political thinking, you know, just because you become more aware of all this stuff. Like you said, growing up, I just didn't think about, it was, you know, kind of racism by omission. You know, I didn't think about it. I grew up in suburban Denver, right? I'm an alley from Columbine. I mean, you can't get more white than the community that I grew up in, right? And so, you know, I'm just trying to make sure that that's not her experience growing up, and then we'll, you know, kind of take things as they come and just try to be open and honest about it. I mean, that's why, like, my big takeaway through all of this is that, like, you have to be candid, you know, and you know, my obviously my experiences in the closet is going to be very different, and you know, it's more challenging for her for a bunch of different ways, but like in the similarity of like pretending like it isn't there isn't the answer, right? So it's just dealing with it and being honest about it and talking about it in candor, and I don't know, hopefully we'll figure it out. Moments of clarity in your as you and your wife deal with this, please share.
I will. Well, thanks for having me. Like you mentioned, I've been supportive, not in the sense that, you know, like I'm a journalist, so I'm trying to say who should vote for who and so on, but in the sense that, like, you know, I think Tim has done something really important, which is like he's doing, you know, getting into writing is hard, and your writing, I think, is very sort of direct and frank and raw and personal and interesting at times. And I think that more people, like, you know, the podcast is great, but I love your pieces because you really bring a lot to the table and are willing to say a lot and willing to concede that you're wrong about some things, or you've rethought some things. And I think more of us in this journalism politics space should be doing that. And I tried to read a piece last month where I wrote about, you know, some of the things I got wrong in the Trump era and how I'm trying to improve and how I'm trying to diversify my media sources and get smarter. And I think what you're doing is, I hope, a model for other people in terms of sort of being open to rethinking their views, not necessarily right or left, but just rethinking what they're doing, rethinking their professions, rethinking how to do this. We need journalism more than ever in this time, but we need to be better, I think. And I think you and the work you're doing has been a model for some of how we can improve.
Well, man, thank you so much. I didn't learn those bad journalism school lessons that you guys all had to learn, right? Right? I don't have to shed any of that baggage. Back at you, Mutual Admiration Society here. Please come back to the Bulwark Podcast, or, you know, we can find some other venues to collaborate. Your perspective is a really big added value for us, for our listeners. I will be back tomorrow with another really special guest you'll like. Peace.